So Friday we discussed the meaning of a distance between quantum states, and we, instead of just giving a mathematical definition of what is a good distance, we built this notion starting from an operational meaning of distinguishing quantum states from the outcomes of experiments and comparing the different probability distributions that we obtain from two different quantum states. So we define distance in terms of statistical distance. And the outcome of all this discussion was that if you define this quantity called the fidelity, which is simply the overlap between two quantum states, the overlap, the modulus of it, then a distance between psi 1 and psi 2 is given by the arccosine of f. Okay, so this is what we ended up with. And now we want to move a step forward, because we want, from this notion of a distance, we want to define a metric tensor on the space of quantum states. Okay? So what we do is that we imagine we have a manifold, and M. On this manifold, we have points that have coordinates lambda 1, lambda n, that collectively we indicate by lambda. Okay, so this is the point lambda. And we want to associate some continuous, at least, actually we will need more than that, a differentiable map from this space of parameters to a family of quantum states. Okay? And we wonder what happens when we have two states that are nearby. Okay, so for instance, when we have the case of psi lambda and psi of, psi lambda plus delta lambda. So because they are very close, these states, their overlap will be close to one. Okay. So their fidelity, which is the modulus of their overlap, is about one. So in this case, our distance we can develop the arccosine, and we get 1 minus f squared. And we can also develop this in a very naive way and obtain this. Okay? So this is all around f close to 1. So this distance, now, this one is defined as the Fubini study metric, Fubini is written as study in English, but it's pronounced study. Okay. And we want to understand what is the square of the line element for this object that from now on we will call dl square, which of course will be 2, 1 minus f. Okay? So our goal will be to compute this object.
So why where does the formula that square root 1 minus f square come from? Is it
from developing arcosine for f near 1?
I mean, is there a factor of 1/2 here? Because the cosine, the expansion cosine is 1 minus 1/2 theta square.
I think that's near f equals 0.
Yes, but oh, I see.
Okay.
No, I mean that's the expansion near the theta. I mean the d near 0, but here d is near 0. Okay.
So for f close to 1, this is the correct expansion. This is my contention. We can check it later together if you okay, so this is what we want to compute. Okay, remark, why we didn't define, well, of course, if we did it this way, we would not see all this statistical meaning. But now that we know that, why we cannot just take some norm on the Hilbert space and say, okay, for me, the distance between two states is just psi 1 minus psi 2 in norm. So, and these are two vectors in the Hilbert space, right? Because this is the norm on the Hilbert space. Okay, beside the fact that we wouldn't understand the statistical and operational meaning of this, could I do this, or are we run in some trouble? What do you think? Let me be more precise. So these are vectors in the Hilbert space. Any idea of what can possibly go wrong if I do that? So what can go wrong is that quantum states are not just the vectors in the Hilbert space, right? They're the rays. So this means that they are the equivalence class of objects of this type. Or using a more sophisticated language, this is a fiber. Okay? And this means that this distance should be invariant by adding any phase, right? So in this case, I would have alpha 1. Here I would have minus AI alpha 2. Or in other words, it should be gauge invariant, right? This is the U1 gauge invariance of quantum mechanics, just because the states are rays. OK, but obviously, this quantity is not invariant by alpha 1 and alpha 2. Right? I can choose alpha 1 and alpha 2, so that these two states interfere, and no matter what they are, their sum is the null vector.
Sir, why we have, is it ray is an overall global phase, not a different phase for different?
Perfect. Yeah, you are absolutely right. This is a global phase for phi.
Yes.
Very good. Now, this means that my state psi 1 is represented by this state.
Yes.
And my state psi 2 must be represented by this state.
Yes.
But now you know that once you want to define the distance by the difference of the states, and then take the norm, now it happens exactly what you are hinting at, that now there is a relative phase.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there was not at this point a relative phase, then the modulus of that would be 1, and we would be fine.
Yes. distance.
But the moment you decide that your distance is the difference between two rays, then you have a relative phase.
Yes.
So that's why this doesn't work. So my remark is exactly why this doesn't work. It's not gauge invariant, right? So what is that could be gauge invariant? The inf of this, right? This would be gauge invariant because then I eliminate alpha 1 and alpha 2. And in part 2 of this course, that is the one that is not mandatory and is valid for the PhD course also. You know, so there will be many problems that we will solve. One of these is to compute this, but the answer is that this is equal to 2(1 - f), which is exactly the Fubini-Steady metric. So you see that if you take care of the gauge invariants, then you kind of magically arrive from our definition in which we already took care of it because all of this is defined from an overlap. And so all this distance was computed starting from considerations. So what happens when you measure stuff? So definitely it has to encode all that there is there in quantum mechanics that has a physical meaning. Okay, yeah?
May I ask?
Sure.
What do you mean by the norm of the difference? Is it a distance?
Is it difference? Yeah, there is a minus here.
So, I mean, the definition of the norm of difference is that the distance, the cosine f.
No. This is the norm in the Hilbert space. So, the norm on the Hilbert space is just right.
Oh yes, yes.
Okay.
What does inf mean?
Huh?
What does inf mean?
It is the inferior. Okay. So it's the minimum value, but inf. It's not just min, right? Because if your set is not closed, every set has an inf, but not every set has a min. Okay, so it's slightly more accurate. if we are in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, that would be also the min. Okay, so now we want to compute this quantity. Okay, so what we will do is to compute the 2(1 - f). What is f? It's here. This is the overlap between the state for the value lambda of your family of states and the value for lambda plus delta lambda. Okay, so how do we do that? We do something very simple. We take psi of lambda plus delta lambda. And because we ask that this family is differentiable at least twice, then we can develop. Okay? And so I have some definitions here that I need to copy. Okay, so I will have psi of lambda plus now, remember that lambda is a point that is actually mapped into coordinates. So when I take the derivative of this, I have to differentiate with respect to each of one. And then multiply by the corresponding differential and sum. Okay? And then at the second order, I will have 1/2 dI/dj psi lambda d lambda I d lambda j and more terms. Okay? However, the object that we want to compute is a differential of the second order. Right? So we do not need to go beyond second order in this expansion, because when we do the inner product between this and this, if we go beyond second order, we also have other terms that we will have to discharge anyway. So if you do this calculation, so this is another of the problems in part two, but you can do it for fun because it is actually elementary. So what you find is this. You find 1/2, and then you have the real part of psi di dj psi plus beta I beta j, that I will define in a second, delta lambda I delta lambda j at the second order. Okay, where what is beta I? Beta I is psi di psi. And minus psi. And those of you who are familiar with Berry faces, will you recognize this is the object that is the face accumulated by a state that is moving in the Hilbert space? Yeah.
Does the real part contain, it's the real part of just the first bracket of all?
No, of all of it. Because the left bracket is not a number. But yeah, I might mean that is the vector, the complex vector where I take just the real parts of the coordinates. No, so it is the real part of everything. It's the real part of this complex number.
Oh, yeah.
This is a complex number, right?
Yeah, but not of beta, plus beta.
It's the real part of this. Yep.
Yeah. Another question. just about the same argument about the phase, the gauge variance.
Yeah.
Here we wrote like psi of lambda plus delta lambda. They could have a different phase than psi of lambda.
No, I know, but we already know that when we take care of the phases, we get to this result. So we don't need to worry anymore. And we also know that if we never thought about this, but we just thought about the statistics of expectation values, which we know they do not depend on the U1 gauge invariance, we know that this statistical distance is this. So at this point, all this U1, so once you arrive at this expression, our U1 gauge invariance is already taken care of. And I discussed this to show you explicitly that if you minded it from the beginning, and you take the inf, you actually land exactly in this expression. Okay. By the way, this real part can be written as minus the real part of di, sorry, let me write it this way, di psi dj psi. This is a consequence of the normalization of states. Okay, so you will have also to do this calculation. And I can just define this number as minus gamma ij.
sorry, why the real part and imaginary I comes from?
This one?
Yeah, and real.
No, this is a definition.
The real part, but in
this is the real part of the. Okay.
In the expansion, there's no real part.
No. What I'm saying is that if you take this state,
yes,
and you do the overlap of this state with all of this,
yes,
you will end up in this expression.
Okay. You mean after?
Just what you see on the blackboard, that this inner product is equal to this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you to see it, you have to do it explicitly.
I see.
It's one of the problems of part two, but. You know, it's just a bit tedious, but it's not complicated. Yeah? I think this is just the inner product. Yes. Thanks for the question. Okay. Okay. So if now you consider the DL square and you put all the terms together, so as you can see, the DL square as this object here. Sorry, I'm still thinking of your question. I think you're actually right. This is this. Thank you.
There should be a one somewhere, right? Because if you put the d lambda goes to zero, we need to recover one. So is it the absolute value of the inner product minus one that is to this, or because we need a one somewhere, which is the value where
No, this is the right expression. No, this is the right expression. So when the d lambda is equal to zero, psi of lambda plus delta lambda is psi of lambda.
Yes, so we get one on the left hand side and zero on the right.
No, you see, when you do the overlap, this times this gives you one of these betas. Okay, so let me do that. So you will have terms that have this form. If you do this multiplication, one of the terms that you will have will be this. Okay, one comes from the fact that you have the overlap of this by this. Okay, and another one comes of the overlap from the overlap.
I agree on the real part. It's just when we do the overlap, we also have the term that is just psi lambda times psi lambda, which should give one. That is good.
No. So what you actually have, if we do all the calculation, is this. Okay, you don't have just this, you also have this. Okay. Now, if I take the derivative of this, what is the derivative of this? Zero. Okay, but this is actually this. So that part cancels.
Okay, so we don't have the first order in d lambda.
Yeah.
We have a zeroth order in d lambda as well.
You should just check the second line
if you take delta lambda to be zero, the left side is actually one, and the right side is actually zero.
We expand, probably expand the side.
Yeah, maybe on the left side we need minus one. Just absolute value of that overlap minus one.
So you're saying if delta lambda goes to zero, okay, yeah, right. You're saying, oh, this goes to zero.
Yeah, left side is just one.
But this goes to one. Yeah, so there, in fact, there should be. Yeah. Yes, because, or yeah, this comes from this thing. There is a one somewhere. You're right. Okay. I think something like one minus two, this, something like this. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you see that the delta L square can actually be written as gamma ij minus beta I beta j delta lambda I delta lambda j. And this object is what we call QIJ. It is called quantum geometric tensor. Okay, let me pull this up. So this is a definition. Now, what is interesting is that Gij, which is the real part of Qij, so if you take the real part of it, you get what is actually a Riemannian tensor. Of type 0,2. So you see the manifold of quantum states defined by this mapping lambda, psi of lambda, can be given a differential geometric structure as a curved manifold with a metric. Now, it's important that this is Riemannian and not pseudo-Riemannian. Okay, so if we wanted to follow this kind of route, to think of something that has to do with the quantum gravity, we have much more work to do, because it's not immediate to understand how you can get a non-trivial signature. But anyway, it is a Riemannian tensor. Also, you have to understand that these lambda coordinates do not necessarily mean real space coordinates. They are just coordinates in this arbitrarily mathematical mapping that to some lambdas associates a quantum state. Okay. Now, of all the map, you know, you can actually invent all the mappings that you want. So for instance,
I don't see how, like, you mentioned quantum gravity over here, because what we are doing right now is just classical quantum mechanics. We are not even taking the idea of there being a multi-particle state. So can we talk about quantum gravity before?
Sure. Yeah. So, okay. So if I wanted to do a theory of gravity with this thing, I should somehow get Einstein's equations, right? So I will have to relate my metric G to the stress energy tensor. Okay, so first of all, I should establish one of these equations. So I should establish what is the right mapping that from lambda goes to psi of lambda such that this object, that is a function of this mapping, then gives me the right stress energy tensor. Okay, and now you see that the first thing that you notice is that if this has to happen, because the stress energy tensor is a function of the real space time coordinates, then I would have established a connection between my quantum geometric tensor and my real space coordinates. Okay. Now, this thing, just like this, doesn't work very well. Okay. Oh, next step to quantize everything would be, okay, now this Tij that is giving me the mapping, I must write it in some operatorial form. Okay, so I would have operators and somehow I've quantized something. Problem is, this is now a Riemannian tensor. Okay, so I do not have the right geometry. It is not really the Einstein equations because it's Riemannian, not pseudo-Riemannian. Okay. And right now, the fact that this is a many-body system is not appearing. Right? This is just, I'm not talking about many-body systems right now. I'm talking about lambda gives you a mapping inside of lambda. Okay? And then you want to find a way to interpret these things as real space-time coordinates. But it just turns out that if you do this way, you can just define not space-time coordinates, but the coordinates on a volume, because it's a Riemannian metric. So just the special part. Okay. So now, okay, so this mapping is completely arbitrary. You see, no matter how you do it, as long as it's differentiable twice, then you can define this stuff. So now we want to bring these notions back to our initial problem. How do we use these distances to talk about quantum phase transitions? And this was our original problem. So in our original problem, what is this mapping? So let's see if we are understanding what we are doing. What is psi of lambda for our problem of quantum phase transitions? Is some arbitrary state that depends arbitrarily on lambda in the Hilbert space, or it's something else? What is our psi of lambda? Is the ground state of H of lambda. So this mapping for our goals is we have H of lambda, which is a local Hamiltonian. And it will have, let me simplify, a unique ground state, psi zero of lambda, for every value of lambda, like we found when we diagonalized the XY model, right? We have an expression of the ground state that depends on the parameters, I don't remember what I call them, eta and h. So for every value of those coordinates that are lambda 1, lambda 2 now, you have a ground state. And now, because you have a ground state that depends on lambda, now this is a family of states that depends on lambda. And now you can compute this object. Okay? And the connection between these states and this object is not immediate. Must be there, right? But we need to find what it is. So, questions before I go ahead? Is this clear? Okay. So now that this is the ground state, and I'm asking, okay, remember, in order to compute our things, we could start from this guy. Now, what is this? This is the new ground state of the Hamiltonian if I change my parameter lambda to lambda plus delta lambda. How can I find it if I know what is psi of lambda and I know the Hamiltonian? What can I do? Can do perturbation theory, right? At the first order. So if you do perturbation theory at the first order, you would get this is approximately psi zero at lambda plus the first order term. And what is the first order term? It's the sum over all the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian at lambda, all the eigenstates but the ground state. And then you, here you have the gap between the corresponding eigenstate and the ground state to the minus one, right? So you are expanding in the eigenstates of your Hamiltonian. And what you have here is the tunneling amplitude between your perturbation, right, and that connects your ground state at lambda with the excited states at lambda. Right? So this is what happens. If I change the lambda a little bit, now my new state is not the eigenstate of the new Hamiltonian, but I can expand it as a superposition of eigenstates of the old Hamiltonian. So it is equal to the old ground state plus excitations above that. And these excitations are given by this amplitude. Here I say there is the perturbation. The perturbation would be this. Let me call it delta H. Right? It's how much I changed my Hamiltonian a little bit. So it is this operator. Okay, so this is just first order perturbation theory. And this is some approximate thing. However, when you want to compute this, so look, this is psi of lambda plus delta lambda. Whereas in our expressions, we have objects that have this form. So this is not just this, right? This is the derivative, which means that it is equal to this term minus this term over delta lambda. And then you take the limit of delta lambda going to zero, right, to get the derivative. So if you do that and compute, so this is again a problem in part two, and compute your Qij using this trick, perturbation theory becomes exact. Why? Okay, so let me tell you why it becomes exact. Perturbation theory at the first order, it just means, okay, that you go to the tangent space, right? First order derivative. And the tangent space is an approximation to the real thing. However, our object is a differential object that lives in the tangent space. In other words, perturbation theory on the tangent space is exact. Right? You are already computing the differential part. So this means that the expression that I'm going to write now becomes exact in the limit of delta lambda going to 0. And so we find that g mu nu will be the real part of our q mu nu. And what is q mu nu going to be? Right? We have to compute objects like that. So this means the overlap of psi times d psi, or the overlaps of d psi times d psi. And each of these terms has more or less this form. So if you put everything together, what you get is the sum over n different from 0. And now you have En of lambda minus E0 of lambda to the power minus 2, right? Because I'm always multiplying two such terms. Times, okay, now you will have, psi, you will have exactly what I wrote here. You will have psi 0, the delta H, psi n, everything is a function of lambda here, this, this, and this. And now again, psi n, let me write delta h later, psi 0. And what is now this delta h is my derivative with respect to mu and my derivative with respect to nu. So I hope the calculation is a bit tedious. So I really suggest you do that. But it should not appear very mysterious that if you just compute all these overlaps between psi and delta psi, or between delta psi and psi, using this formula, it should not be too mysterious the fact that you get an expression like this. Yeah?
First, you were using lenses I and J. Here, you're using mu and nu. Is there anything different between the two?
Oh, no. Sorry. I changed notation. And I know it's very bad. Sorry, I changed notation. Okay. Good. So let's apply. Okay, so you see now we have a closed formula that gives us a g mu nu, where you know the ground state for every lambda. Well, not just the ground states. You need to know the all eigenstates for every lambda, and your Hamiltonian operator for every lambda. Okay? So, you know, you can just apply this formula. So let's apply these findings to the quantum XY model that we have diagonalized. Okay, so let me rewrite again the Hamiltonian here. And so this is the sum between minus m and m, which means that n, the number, total number of spin is this. And then I have 1 plus gamma over 2 xx plus 1 minus gamma over 2 yy plus lambda z. And it should be obvious what I mean by this. Xx means sigma x at the site I. Sigma x at the site I plus 1, yy should be sigma y, and z would be sigma z at the site I. Okay? And we remember that the ground state, as a function of our parameter that are gamma and lambda, could be written as just the tensor product with k of cosine theta k over 2 0, 0 plus I sine theta k over 2, 1, 1. And this means k minus k, k minus k. Okay. Okay, so you see, in this specific case of the quantum XY model, the ground state as a function of lambda is just a tensor product. So this means that in general, if I have a new ground state for different values, gamma tilde, lambda tilde, and I want to compute the overlap, this is going to be very easy, right? Because since these are two tensor products, the inner product of a tensor product is just the ordinary product of all the overlaps. So for this specific ground state, it is easier to compute directly f instead of going through that formula. And so in general, the overlap of the ground state that I'm calling G, okay, for two different values of my parameters lambda, I'm sorry for the okay, so this is lambda. So, this is H, this is H, and for lambda for me is the collective variables gamma and H. Okay. So the overlap for the ground states for two different lambdas is given by just the product of theta bar minus theta for every k over 2. The cosine of this. So, you know, this is another exercise. Just take the overlap of this with the overlap of this, and you know, you will see that you have a product of terms with k. Then you do some trigonometry, and you see that it's just equal to this. So knowing this overlap, now one can easily compute the G mu nu. So Lauren, I don't remember. Do we have these calculations in a tutorial or in a homework? And it is it for part two, right? And it's for part two. So these are just, but these are tedious but straightforward derivations from this formula. So if now you compute G mu nu, you will see that you will have 1/4 the sum over k of just these derivatives. Okay. So this is the Riemannian tensor. Okay, so you see this is a very beautiful and compact expression because you see you all the information about the ground states is contained in the variables theta, right? Because this theta tells you, remember, they depend on gamma and h. And you take the derivative in the mu and nu direction, and this matrix of the derivatives in the mu and nu direction is, the real part of it is g mu nu. Where is the only difficulty? The only difficulty is that this is a series, right? And you know, so you have all these terms, and well, there are not so many terms because this is case like n, so you can put it in a computer, or you can do something smarter and show that this becomes m over 2 pi. Maybe there is, I still have this 1/4, and I integrate between 0 and pi this object, in dx. Right? If I take the thermodynamic limit, now my variable k becomes a continuous variable x, and I can, instead of doing this sum, I can do the integral. And if you do that, you finally find for modulus of h smaller than 1, let me show you the result for this case. So you find the G mu, right? So it's a matrix. How large is this matrix? The matrix G mu nu?
N by n.
No, not n by n. 2 by 2. What are mu and nu? And nu are their directions, right? The directions are gamma and h. This is mu nu in the space of parameters.
The other one was m by m, right?
It's small n times small n, which in this case, small n is 2. It's the number of parameters, right? So the dimensionality of M has nothing to do with the dimensionality of the Hilbert space. It's the dimensionality of the manifold that defines the family of states. So that's why I started in this way, in which psi of lambda could be just a qubit, if you want. Psi of lambda could live in a very low dimensional Hilbert space, but it depends on many parameters. Okay? So we must not mix these two dimensionalities. They both play a role. So this is a 2 by 2 matrix that reads 1 minus h squared to the minus 1, 0, 0, 1 plus absolute value of gamma to the minus 2. Okay, so this is valid for h smaller than 1. Remember our phase diagram, which we had gamma and h, and h smaller than 1 means this region. And we said that for gamma, for h smaller than 1, all this region is critical, which corresponds to gamma equals 0. And indeed, you see that if gamma goes to 0, this object diverges, right? Because, I have something wrong in my notes. Yeah, no, it's I swapped gamma and lambda.
Oh my,
yeah, I swapped gamma and lambda. So I think it's like this. No, it's still not good. Oh man, what did they do?
Alyosha, I think it's supposed to be just 1 over, the first element is just 1 over 16 absolute value.
Oh, right, I forgot the prefactor. You're right, okay, yeah, no, thank you. Okay, so this was right, okay. And I forgot the prefactor here, which is n over 16 gamma. Okay, thank you, Lauren. And so you see that for gamma going to 0, diverges because of this. This is finite, but this diverges because of this. So we catch this part of the phase transition. Now, the result of this integral is very complicated for h greater than 1. But one thing that we can compute is the, we have a metric, so we can compute the Riemannian curvature, and then the Riemann tensor, and then the Ricci scalar, right? So you know all these formulae. And if you, and this is actually more manageable to compute. And if you compute it, you find that for lambda, absolute value of lambda smaller than 1, this gives you minus 16 over n, 1 plus gamma over gamma. And for lambda greater than 1, 16 over n, you have lambda plus square root of lambda square plus gamma square minus 1. And what I'm calling here lambda is h. Square root of, okay, let me put h. H square plus gamma square minus 1. And the point is, you can see that the Ricci scalar is discontinuous at lambda equal 1. See, it has two different values. So this means that this, if the Ricci scalar is discontinuous, then the metric is non-analytic. So this catches these other two critical lines. Okay. So you see that this method of associating a geometry to the space of ground, the manifold of ground states of a Hamiltonian depending on some parameters, has the double meaning of giving a Riemannian structure to this manifold, and it catches quantum phase transitions as the points where this metric becomes singular. But if you wanted to be very critical, you could say, okay, this is a nice mathematical game, but what is that I have understood more about quantum phase transitions? After all, I knew everything about the quantum XY model, which is true. So the point of this is not to understand better the quantum XY model, but to develop a method that does not make any reference to symmetry. Okay? And it also makes no reference to directly the shrinking of the gap. We're going to see why the shrinking of the gap comes about. And in fact, let me just do that. Let me show how it comes out. Because now it gives us a method. If I have another ways of defining different ground states for models where there is no change of symmetry. So before, I didn't know what to do. Okay, I didn't know if there was a quantum phase transition in between. Now I can compute the quantum geometric tensor and see if there is a singularity. The singularity is not just something mathematical, has the meaning that suddenly two states that are very close, I change a little bit the parameters and they become very distinguishable. Notice that this Riemannian tensor scales with n. Okay, so that when n is very, very large, it blows up. But when gamma goes to 0, this blows up also because of gamma. So the right quantity that you need to look at to see quantum phase transition is the rescaled geometric tensor. So you rescale it by 1 over n, And this is a little bit what we did when we rescaled. You remember the distance, the statistical distance by 1 over square root of n. It has a little bit to do with that. But now you, so every geometric tensor has an extensive behavior, so you have to rescale it by n. But at quantum critical points, this divergence is super extensive. Even when you rescale it by n, it still diverges. Okay. So now let me do this part of the. Let me give a general argument about how, from our expression of the quantum geometric tensor, so let me write, this was the real part of delta, the first, the gap between n and 0 to the minus 2, and then we had the sum n different from 0, and here you had psi 0 delta mu h psi n delta nu h psi 0. Okay. So now let me give you a general argument. Okay, so not just something that works for the quantum XY model. Okay. So consider this operator as a linear operator. So you see, once I take these inner products, this is a matrix of numbers. This is an operator in the Hilbert space. This is an operator in the Hilbert space. But once I contract them with the states, these are just complex numbers, right? And then I take the real part. So this is just a real matrix in the space mu nu. Okay? So let phi I, how many be the eigenvectors of this symmetric matrix? So it will have eigenvectors. How many eigenvectors do we have?
Smaller.
Huh?
Smaller.
Small n. This is an n by n matrix. So the number of these eigenvectors has nothing to do with the dimension of the Hilbert space. I wrote them as cats, but these are not quantum states. Okay, these are just vectors. So you know, I don't know. You can call them this way if you want, so that you don't think of the Hilbert space. These are just the vectors that are the eigenvectors of this matrix G mu nu. And they come with, oh, okay, so the reason why I call them cats is because I want to use, they come with an eigenvalue phi I. So Dirac notation is convenient because of this, right? This is the eigenvector eigenvalue phi I. So now let phi without I be the eigenvector corresponding to the maximum eigenvalue. Right? I will have n eigenvalues phi I, then one of them will be the largest one, and to that one corresponds the largest eigenvector. Sorry, not the largest eigenvector, corresponds to some eigenvector, the eigenvector of largest eigenvalue. Okay. And then, so if I look at the absolute value of this matrix element, this is of course upper bounded by this. Right? It's upper bounded by the expectation value of the matrix in the eigenvector of maximum eigenvalue. You know, this is what gives meaning to the notion of operator norm. Operator norm is the maximum eigenvalue of an operator. It's something that bounds from above all the possible matrix elements or expectation values. Okay. So equipped with this, Now consider a basis in mu in this space. Okay? So of course this basis in this basis I can write this vector in this way. Let me call these things. So I'm expanding my vector of maximal eigenvalue in some basis. Okay. And now let me define this scalar number, delta H, which is the sum of this operator times these numbers. So you see that this object upper bounds any value that you can have from this. Okay? So because of this, then we can write that these matrix elements can be upper bounded by the sum for n different from zero, my gap to the power minus 2. And now I have psi 0. So let me write it like this. Psi n times psi n psi 0. I upper bounded, right? Because I got the object that gives me the maximum eigenvalue in the mu nu space. And psi 0 delta h psi nu psi n delta h psi 0 is the modulus square. Okay. Now that I wrote this in this way, that these are all positive numbers, I can upper bound further by considering the minimum gap, right? The one with the first excited state, which we just call delta. And now let me reopen this. Okay. Is this fair? Do you agree? Okay. Now, how much I would like to use the resolution of the identity here? Why I cannot do that? Huh?
Zero?
Yeah, we need the sum over all n's. We needed the term zero. Before I could not. So one thing I can do is that I can insert it and subtract it, right? Mm-hmm. Before I couldn't do it because this object was inside the sum. So first of all, it was depending on n. Then it would also diverge. But now I got rid of it. And now what I can do is that I sum over all the things, then I have to subtract it, right? So I will have psi 0 delta h psi 0 square, right? Psi 0 delta h psi 0. And what happens when I insert the resolution of the identity here? So we have delta to the minus 2, and then we don't have the sum over n anymore. And we have psi 0, so let me write it this way, delta h times delta h, where the expectation value is taken just in the ground state. And this is beautiful because this is saying my matrix elements are upper bounded by the fluctuations of the Hamiltonian in the ground state. Okay, so I need to stop here. But you see that we starting seeing why the gap, the inverse gap plays a role. So if in some way I can bound this term, then I can talk about delta, which is what we're gonna do tomorrow. Okay, thank you.